To the rich man's bright lodges I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 515 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show, we'll be looking at Iran. I don't watch corporate media, but I've picked up a lot of alternative media suggesting that the corporate media, Mighty Wurlitzer, has started up talking a lot of nonsense about Iran's nuclear capacities. And it all sounds quite familiar. There are some revealing alternative radio shows out there. So, I wanted to provide you with something of relevance to Iran, but not repeat that material. Our second hour is a lecture by Stephen Kinzer on the book All the Shah's Men about the 1953 coup d'etat. That was staged by the CIA, nominally under the anti-communist tag, but on a more sober analysis, largely influenced by pragmatic decisions such as the desire to make a lot of money from Iran's oil. Our first hour is a lively presentation from the irrepressible Webster Tarpley. It comes to us courtesy of Guns and Butter. I'm almost sure you'll find some parts of this presentation objectionable, and I did wonder whether or not to broadcast it. Ever outspoken, Webster Tarpley denounces WikiLeaks.org as what he terms a limited hangout, which is not the anti-establishment chance to bear people's dirty laundry in public, but in fact controlled by the establishment, a site which looks interestedly at people who submit secrets and presents a limited selection of them for public display, but whilst appearing to criticise the establishment, actually subtly supports it and diverts people's attention from the truth. That's quite an accusation, and I thought I should spell it out just so that it's in the back of your mind as you listen to this. I've got no information of my own, but I thought I should draw your attention to an interview about WikiLeaks from the Belfast Telegraph from last month. The title of their piece is Wanted by the CIA, Julian Assange, which makes much of the anti-establishment nature of the website, and yet this quote jumped out at me. What was 9/11? Julian Assange, WikiLeaks editor-in-chief, replies, I'm constantly annoyed that people are distracted by false conspiracies such as 9/11, when all around we provide evidence of real conspiracies for war or mass financial fraud. So then, bearing that in mind, now here is Bonnie Faulkner's interview with Webster Tarpley, entitled The WikiLeaks Limited Hangout and the Coming War with Iran.
Interesting enough that Assange and WikiLeaks are able to get the New York Times and Der Spiegel and the London Guardian to put this stuff out. Which, if you've ever done anything, if you've ever had something, an important story that the U.S. government and the U.S. establishment and Wall Street didn't want published, you know that you don't get it in the New York Times. Spiegel was famous for their hysterical attacks on anybody who didn't believe the 9/11 official story. And of course, the London Guardian is the left wing, or center left, I guess you'd say, of British intelligence, MI6. And the London Guardian, I think, had the clearest. Their summary articles were, you know, why Pakistan is betraying the U.S. and secondly, what the Iranians are doing. And then the top article, of course, was that why the Afghanistan war is essentially futile and already lost. So it fits in perfectly with what's going on in the corridors of power.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Webster Tarpley. Today's show, the WikiLeaks limited hangout and the coming war with Iran. Webster Tarpley is an economic historian, author, and lecturer. He is author of Against Oligarchy, Surviving the Cataclysm, A Study of the World Financial Crisis, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA, and co-author of George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography. His latest books are Obama, The Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, and Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. Today we discuss his most recent article, Obama is Preparing to Bomb Iran, of July 21st, 2010. This article is 30 pages long and contains 70 footnotes. Webster Tarpley, welcome again.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me.
Webster, I'm looking at the New York Times, July 25th, 2010, Pakistan aids insurgency in Afghanistan, reports assert. And of course, the reports that we're referring to here are the WikiLeaks, this by Mark Mazzetti et al. Now, the article says, quote, Lieutenant General Hamid Gul ran the ISI, of course, that's the Pakistani Intelligence Service, from 1987 to 1989, a time when Pakistani spies and the CIA joined forces to run guns and money to Afghan militias who were battling Soviet troops in Afghanistan. After the fighting stopped, he maintained his contacts with the former Mujahideen, who would eventually transform themselves into the Taliban. And more than two decades later, it appears that General Gul is still at work. The documents indicate that he has worked tirelessly to reactivate his old networks, employing familiar allies like Jalaluddin Haqqani and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, whose networks of thousands of fighters are responsible for waves of violence in Afghanistan. General Gul is mentioned so many times in the reports, if they are to be believed, that it seems unlikely that Pakistan's current military and intelligence officials could not know of at least some of his wide-ranging activities. The United States has pushed the United Nations to put General Gul on a list of international terrorists, and top American officials said they believed he was an important link between active-duty Pakistani officers and militant groups. General Gul, who says he is retired and lives on his pension, dismissed the allegations as, quote, absolute nonsense, speaking by telephone from his home in Rawalpindi, where the Pakistani army keeps its headquarters. Quote, I have had no hand in it, he added. American intelligence is pulling cotton wool over your eyes. Well, when I read this, I thought, well, Hamid Gul, he's the same retired head of the ISI who, after the events of September 11th, 2001, gave a public interview and said that 9/11 was an inside job. And here the WikiLeaks documents are fingering him as an enemy of the United States and claiming that insinuating that Pakistan is stabbing the U.S. in the back. And I thought to myself, well, now, whose interests do these WikiLeaks serve? What do you think about this?
Well, first of all, I think that's the relevant question that you very correctly asked, and it's a service to your listeners that you've asked it. Now, I'll attempt to give the answer that I would tried to develop through research now in the past, quite a few months. It is that this document dump by WikiLeaks and by this the leader of it, Julian Assange, is an intelligence operation of the U.S. intelligence community, and we can be very sure that the documents in that document dump are, first of all, very low-level intelligence. They hardly rise to the level of secret. If they're classified as secret, they're over-classified. They're really just official use only, confidential, and if they're lucky, secret. But more importantly, that this low-level intelligence has been carefully edited and cherry-picked to do the tasks that are now urgent for the U.S. intelligence community as the U.S. prepares to lift and shift the current war deployments into a much wider and more dangerous war. Now, the demonization of Pakistan, of course, has been the keystone to this entire policy, especially since Obama's West Point speech of December 2009, which was, in my reading of it, as well as the correspondent of one of the Pakistani television networks here that I've been in contact with, it's a declaration of war against Pakistan, because it basically says the goal of the U.S. policy is to export the Afghan civil war into Pakistan and break up Pakistan, to foment the rebellion of the Pashtun people and the Balochistan population against the central government there in Islamabad, the Punjabis and the Sindh population on the other side, and get a civil war that leads to the breakup of Pakistan four ways, perhaps, or perhaps even more. The reason for that in very brief terms is because if you're going to have an oil pipeline from Iran and the rest of the Middle East into China, it just about has to go through Pakistan. And you could also have an oil pipeline from the Middle East into India. These are absolutely critical strategic things that the U.S., the British, and others don't want. So their goal is to destroy Pakistan. But there was always, in the middle of Obama's war policy, this Rube Goldberg aspect. In other words, it made no sense, even on the surface. If your goal is this so-called Al-Qaeda, which I think doesn't really exist in the way that most people think it does, if you want to attack Al-Qaeda, then go where you say they are. And, of course, the U.S. line is that Al-Qaeda is actually located in Pakistan, be it in Pashtunistan or Waziristan, the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan, or in Balochistan, in this place called Quetta. And we're told about the Quetta Shura that appears in the papers where bin Laden supposedly goes. According to these papers, there is such a person as Osama bin Laden. He's alive, which I think is quite fantastic, mythological. And he's not just a traveling theatrical company or hologram speaking from Langley, Virginia, but he's a real person, and he goes to the Quetta Shura. So you can see that the U.S. goal had been then to foment those rebellions. Now, what I think we've got now is the situation is complicated because the whole institutional bureaucracy here in Washington is moving towards an attack on Iran, and it's moving towards an attack on Iran very, very rapidly. Let me just cite one or two predicates, if I may, just to establish why we're going towards this attack on Iran. And there were many reasons that we can go through. We're taping here on August 7th, and I would point people to a very interesting fact. Fidel Castro in Havana, the secretary of the Cuban Communist Party, has convoked a special session of the Cuban parliament today, and he gave them an address in which he says the purpose of this is to discuss an imminent nuclear war between the United States on the one side, with Israel joining in, and on the other side, Iran and North Korea, he says. Obama will give the order of the announced and expected attack. And Castro says, I want him to know that he will be ordering the instant death not only of hundreds of millions of people, including a countless number of people from his own country, but also of the U.S. troops and fleet around Iran. Now, we had Ahmadinejad last week, the leader of Iran, saying that the U.S. is planning to attack two Middle Eastern countries over the next 3 months. We've had the first serious shooting incident along the Israeli-Lebanese border, and of course Hezbollah in those Lebanese territories is a close ally of Iran. So we had a first shooting incident there since the war 4 years ago between Lebanon and Israel. And we've also had a kind of a dress rehearsal for a false flag event in the Straits of Hormuz, which is what the United Arab Emirates and I guess the U.S. now say was a small boat loaded with explosives that did not even blow a hole in the side of a Japanese supertanker, but severely dented it and forced it to put into port. So we've got all kinds of threats going back and forth. Last Sunday on one of the television interview shows, Admiral Mullen, the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said the United States has an active war plan to attack Iran. It turns out that war plan would have been developed by the Central Command during the time that General Petraeus was the commander there, Petraeus now having been elevated to almost Caesaresque or Napoleonic status by Obama, by giving him the Afghan front in the middle of all this. But I think we've got a very highly developed, extremely ominous pattern of intelligence that points to this attack on Iran. One more is that the new British Prime Minister David Cameron had a Freudian slip when he said in one of his speeches, "We're doing what we're doing in the Middle East because Iran has a nuclear weapon already." Now, I think that guy's got a mind like a rag bag, and he repeats what he's talking about inside number 10 Downing Street. So maybe we'll get another Downing Street memorandum on this, but I think that the general pattern is clear. There had been a period of about 2 to 2.5 years during which the danger of an attack on Iran, I think, was very low, partly because Zbigniew Brzezinski, George Soros, and their group were promising that with a green revolution in Iran, with a kind of a color revolution or CIA people power coup, they could provide a government in Tehran which would be anti-Russian and anti-Chinese. And indeed, that Mousavi faction in the streets was always chanting, "Death to Russia, death to China." But that whole thing has failed. So there will be no color revolution in Iran. And rather, as Hillary Clinton complains, what you've got there looks pretty much like a military government. Looks a little bit like Nasser in Egypt, or perhaps the military government in Iraq under Qassem back in the 1960s and 70s. But it's not a government of mullahs anymore, but it's not going to be what the U.S. Wants. So it seems to me we are moving towards an attack on Iran. Now, if you then look at the region, if your main goal is to subvert Pakistan, and at the same time you're going to attack Iran, you've got to do something about your forces in Afghanistan, because as even Castro says in that brief quote that I gave you, if there is such an attack, the situation of the U.S. forces in Iraq and in Afghanistan could become very critical very fast, because they could be surrounded and indeed overrun by all kinds of pro-Iranian or Iranian irregular forces, volunteers, cutting supply lines, rendering communications impossible, and so forth. This would be a regional war of very, very grave significance, with all kinds of paths to go nuclear. But among other things, you've got to get your forces out of this very exposed position in Afghanistan. Now, I have in front of me the Wall Street Journal of Thursday, July 29th, and here we have something that's been, it's now called in intelligence circles, jokingly known as the divine plan. And by divine plan, I don't mean God's plan. I mean the plan developed by Jack Devine, former CIA deputy director of operations. So he's the head of the clandestine services, Mr. Wetwork. And what he basically says is the conventional war in Afghanistan is pointless. It's futile. You've got to get the Army and the Marines and the land forces in general out of there. What you need is Predator drones flying overhead, killing people with reckless abandon. And you need some special forces, perhaps. You need some CIA death squads. You need to negotiate with those drug lords and warlords that essentially the U.S. has been working with. The ones that you just mentioned, right? Hekmatyar and the Haqqani Network are exactly the ones that the U.S. Has turned to in the past, and the Northern Alliance. Don't forget them. And the goal will then be to have the CIA run Afghanistan with minimum interference or presence of U.S. ground forces. This is what was known as the Biden plan during the debate about a year ago. But now here it is, dished up in the same week as WikiLeaks. Now, where does WikiLeaks, and I should mention before leaving this, that the reason the CIA would like this, among other things, is that that would give them the ability to corner the world heroin and opium market. They could essentially become the biggest drug lords in the world if it were total CIA control of Afghanistan, with no need to cut in anybody else. Now, if we look at the document dumped by WikiLeaks, we will see that the mental map, or the strategic configuration that emerges from the document dump, is identical to the policies that seem to be gaining ground here in Washington at the moment. In other words, what I see here in Washington is the big idea is it's time to cut your losses in Afghanistan, if at all possible, at least pull in your horns, step up the efforts to subvert Pakistan and break up that government, anything you can do there. But above all, the centerpiece is now in military aggression. And, of course, whether it's the Israelis who strike first and the U.S. gets plausible deniability, or whether the U.S. strikes first and the Israelis benefit from being only the second ones in, I think this is immaterial. We know from an article by Joe Klein in Time magazine that the planning is now joint. In other words, U.S. and Israeli planners have been working together under Petraeus to plan this for the last several years.
Webster, let me interrupt you here. Now, the United States government, Strategic Command, etc., they've been drawing up plans to attack Iran for many years now. But you feel that presently that these things are escalating?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's why I put a great deal of effort to get that intelligence picture out on July 21st. Now, it's been followed. If you're familiar with the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, it's the group that's associated with Ray McGovern and some others. They have a statement here, I think, dated August 4th, which is much narrower. There we go, August 3rd, memorandum from the president, from Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, subject war with Iran. We alert you to the likelihood that Israel will attack Iran as early as this month. This would likely lead to a wider war. So that at least they have. I think they leave out the indispensable idea that the way war is going to come is either through a Gulf of Tonkin incident, like what we've just seen with that Japanese tanker getting attacked with explosives in Hormuz, or through some kind of 9/11 event. In other words, a domestic staged false flag terror event. And on that, we have a guy named Shapiro, is a top official of the Clinton administration and a big Bilderberger group activist, quoted in the London Financial Times, where he says, if Obama wants to assert his leadership, given the fact that he's lost the confidence of the American people, Obama would need either a new 9/11 or a new Oklahoma City domestic terrorism event so that he could look presidential, and this has to happen before November. Arnaud de Borchgrave, veteran columnist, TV debater, and so forth, with lots of European intelligence connections, has said that his diagnosis is he thinks Obama wants to have three wars so that he can have two houses of Congress, and that would imply something in October. And again, this gets us back to Ahmadinejad, right? Attack two countries in 3 months. Now, at the end of my essay, I said what you have to watch out for in these circumstances is, of course, figure that if such an attack, if it comes, is going to be a sneak attack under cover of darkness. And the time, since you're dealing with these stealth bombers and stealth cruise missiles, they can be seen. They're not that fast, and they can be seen, and they can be shot down. So it's probably going to be in the dark of the moon. And the new moon is August 10th, September 8th, and October 7th. So I would regard those as periods of maximum danger. This is a dismal exercise that we learned back in 06 and 07 at the time of Operation Bite. Remember that one, the Good Friday attack on Iran that had been trumpeted by the Russian intelligence agencies. And indeed, RIA Novosti is joining in again with the article that I mentioned, saying that according to a guy from the Institute of Strategic Culture, which is where General Ivashov works, that the U.S. is likely to attack Iran. And it's not just Iran with its regional allies of Hezbollah, Hamas, Syria, and so forth, but perhaps Venezuela would be in this somehow. If the U.S. decides to unleash Colombia against Venezuela, then you'd have the beginnings of a world war. It would be more than even a very severe regional war in the Middle East. But the point I was trying to get to, though, is you look at WikiLeaks, what is the general burden? What's the message that comes out of all these 90,000 low-level dispatches? Basically three things. The Afghan war is hopeless, gets you nowhere. Secondly, that Pakistan is treacherous. They betray you. They kill you. They're enemies, right? So do whatever you can against the Pakistani government. But the other one is Iran, that Iran is also doing everything they can to cause the deaths and defeat of the U.S. forces in Afghanistan. I think this was very clear in the London Guardian version of these papers, right? Interesting enough that Assange and WikiLeaks are able to get the New York Times and Der Spiegel and the London Guardian to put this stuff out. Which, if you've ever done anything, if you've ever had something, an important story that the U.S. government and the U.S. establishment and Wall Street didn't want published, you know that you don't get it in the New York Times. Spiegel was famous for their hysterical attacks on anybody who didn't believe the 9/11 official story. They had a cover story saying conspiracy fanatics turned the world on its head, where they had the two trade towers in New York City upside down and burning. And of course, the London Guardian is the left wing, or center left, I guess you'd say, of British intelligence, MI6. And the London Guardian, I think, had the clearest. Their summary articles were, you know, why Pakistan is betraying the U.S., and secondly, what the Iranians are doing. And then the top article, of course, was that why the Afghanistan war is essentially futile and already lost. So it fits in perfectly with what's going on in the corridors of power.
Well, I was going to bring that up, that this head of WikiLeaks, Assange, I guess, that he would have these three mainstream media outlets like, as you say, The Guardian, Der Spiegel, New York Times. He had these newspapers vet the leaks.
Right. Look, this is now so absurd. If Assange has servers, the Department of Defense can destroy his servers within 30 minutes or less, using the hackers they have, the electronic countermeasures that they have. They can unleash all kinds of forces that can shut down websites. And again, during the 9/11 truth movement, we got to know what these methods were. Some of them were administrative harassment. Some of them were direct hacking attacks under, you know, various kinds of cover. The other thing is the U.S. government could get him extradited. He showed up in Britain and gave a press conference in London on that very day. So he could have been rounded up and taken into custody. I guess one of his people has been taken into custody, but there's no coordinated event effort to do anything about him.
Well, right. I was going to say, here he is in London in the middle of a police state, and they're claiming that he's wanted and they're after him. I mean, that's crazy.
This is simply part of his legend, right? Part of his cover story. It's indispensable for the dupes and gulls of the public to believe in Assange. They've got to believe that he's somehow being persecuted by the U.S. intelligence community, which is simply not the case. The other thing they could do to him is what they've done to so many people. They could subject him to illegal rendition, kidnapping. In other words, what they did to the imam in Milan, or dozens, scores, hundreds, as far as we know, of other people. I mentioned the Milan imam because they're you know, 30 CIA agents have been convicted in that one. It's the best documented one. What they would do is grab him, drug him, push him into a car, take him to a NATO base, beat him up, torture him, drug him again, put him on an airplane, and take him to some black site, maybe in Eastern Europe or in Egypt or someplace in the Middle East, and that would be the end of Assange. So that does not happen.
Or they could put him on a no-fly list, right?
Certainly, they could harass him. Then the obvious other issue with Assange is he says that he's this nomad, right? He's a picaresque agent, and he flies around the world, and he lives out of a backpack. Wonderful. Who pays? The general impression that we get looking at the internet, based on published reports and other maybe unconfirmed reports, is that this is paid for by Soros. In other words, ultimately, this is the group of foundations around the Open Society Foundation and similar entities controlled ultimately by George Soros and his right-hand man, Morten Halperin. And I would mention that Morten Halperin gives us a personal union between this current mind control operation, because that's what it is, and the Pentagon Papers of 1971, the famous Ellsberg caper. Remember that Morten Halperin, together with Leslie Gelb, worked in the Pentagon under McNamara starting in 1967 to assemble this history, I guess you'd say, of the Vietnam War, which was then leaked by Ellsberg to the New York Times, and then when Nixon, you know, moved with various injunctions to shut that down. It went on to the Washington Post and the Boston Globe, and ultimately the U.S. government under Nixon lost that case. But Morton Halperin is the guy who essentially, you know, with Gelb, and then Ellsberg came in, put this stuff together. So Halperin has not been persecuted. He's sitting as the right-hand man there at the Open Society Foundation. And you've also got Leslie Gelb became for a while the president of the Council on Foreign Relations. So he was not persecuted either. And we could draw lots of parallels between them, and I hope we can later in the broadcast. But generally, it's the same idea. It's what is called in intelligence parlance a limited hangout. It's a way to say something good about somebody while you're pretending to be saying something bad. It's a way to say, essentially, it's a way to say the United States should really think about attacking Pakistan and Iran while you're pretending to be, you know, a anti-authoritarian rebel and with posturing of the type that that Assange does. It's disinformation. It is a self-exposure, I guess we'd say.
I'm speaking with economic historian and author Webster Tarpley. Today's show, the WikiLeaks limited hangout and the coming war with Iran. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Well, everybody is saying that calling Julian Assange the new Daniel Ellsberg.
Well, here's what I would say. You look at the Pentagon Papers of 1971, and you will see that they were subjected to exactly the same kind of selection and editing and slanting that we see with this WikiLeaks document dump. The Pentagon Papers of 1971 had nothing new in them. If you had been reading Le Monde of Paris or any of the Italian papers, and I say this as somebody who did do these things, did read the Italian papers and the Le Monde when I could get it, there was nothing in the Pentagon Papers that you didn't know. You knew it all. So what was the big deal? Well, it was the government's own history, and it had some things in it that were rather scandalous. But then you look at a deeper level. What were the three things that were going on with the Pentagon Papers? The first thing is a complete whitewash of the CIA, that the CIA role in Vietnam is completely whitewashed and sanitized. And that's interesting because Ellsberg himself had worked in Vietnam. He had been a Marine. He had worked with General Ed Lansdale. And according to published reports that I've seen, he was part of Ed Lansdale's Revolutionary Development Program, which some people know under the name of Operation Phoenix. And what this was the systematic assassination of those people who were thought to be Viet Cong cadre, communist cadre, guerrillas. And really, in practice, what this meant was that if you could read and write, if you were a teacher, you were assumed to be a communist intellectual, and you were eligible for assassination. And this entire complex did not come into play. And again, Ed Lansdale is, that's General Y in Oliver Stone's JFK film. Ed Lansdale is the ugly American in Lederer, well, he figures in Lederer and Burdick's Ugly American, and he's also the quiet American in Graham Greene's novel. He's a CIA general, but the CIA role is completely whitewashed in the Pentagon Papers. The second thing in the Pentagon Papers is the demonization of John F. Kennedy as the ultimate villain and aggressor in everything, an attempt to rewrite history in this way. Essentially, we have Kennedy's National Security Action Memorandum 263, I believe, is the number, which issued on October 10th, 1963, called for the exit of all U.S. forces from Vietnam by the end of 1965, which beginning after the 64 election, and everybody home within 1 year. This is not mentioned. There's no mention of the Kennedy assassination. There's nothing about any of the interfaces between Kennedy and the people involved in the war planning, right? Differences of opinion, right? Kennedy's desire to get out. This is all completely suppressed. So, and it's very interesting. The people who came on the scene as the groupies and supporters of Ellsberg included Howard Zinn. Now, the late Howard Zinn, but above all, Noam Chomsky. And you can look at Noam Chomsky. He has been arguing that same implicit line ever since. It was the line that Kennedy was an aggressor, that Kennedy wanted to continue the war in Vietnam, and for the defense of the CIA, naturally, Chomsky says that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone assassin who acted alone, and there was no conspiracy. And, of course, the conspiracy was the CIA Directorate of Operations, the people that Kennedy had been attacking. Kennedy had fired Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA. He fired Richard Bissell, another top CIA honcho, and some others. But Chomsky has been arguing ever since that none of that ever happened. So he's still on the Ellsberg line, I guess we can say. The third thing that the papers did, right, in addition to whitewashing the CIA and demonizing Kennedy, the third thing was to drive Richard Nixon berserk, because in that time, 1971, during the course of the year, Nixon had been driven berserk by Jack Anderson and his running reporter, right? Britt Hume, source eggnog, had been getting these papers saying, talking about this, the so-called tilt crisis, the separation of Bangladesh from the rest of Pakistan, which is interesting. They've always been trying to divide Pakistan into smaller pieces. And Nixon had been driven berserk by these leaks because he, of course, was a paranoid personality. He didn't like leaks. And Jack Anderson and Britt Hume were publishing all these things from people inside the State Department, especially, who didn't agree with Nixon's tilt in favor of Pakistan under Yahya Khan, because they wanted to use Yahya Khan as the entree to China for the China card. So there was this going on in the background. Now, when the Pentagon Papers come out, and you see this in Oliver Stone's Nixon movie, Nixon goes berserk again, and in this case, he orders the creation of the plumbers. In other words, the plumbers, the Watergate plumbers, are a direct byproduct of the Pentagon Papers leaked by Ellsberg. Now, Ellsberg had worked not just for the Rand Corporation as a nuclear planner, and not just for General Ed Lansdale in Vietnam. He had also worked for Henry Kissinger as part of Henry Kissinger's staff at the National Security Council in the White House. When the Pentagon Papers came out, the plumbers were created, and the guy who was tasked with creating them was one of Ellsberg's colleagues, one of his co-workers, another member of Kissinger's staff, David Young, who created the plumbers. And who did he invite in? Well, he invited James McCord of the CIA, Office of Security. He invited in Howard Hunt, another CIA stalwart, right? Some people think he had a lot to do with the Kennedy assassination. And indeed, Gordon Liddy of the FBI and God knows what else. And then when the time came to expose the whole thing, who led the charge on that? Well, it was Bob Woodward from the Office of Naval Intelligence, I guess we'd say, somebody whose task had been to run the naval ship, which would have been used as a seagoing command post for Nixon in case of nuclear war, meaning that he had to be kept up on all intelligence at the very highest cosmic level. So this was Watergate in a nutshell. In other words, it was a coup d'etat against the presidency, and it was welcomed by a lot of people. I think this is relevant for us today. They hated Nixon, and I suppose we can see why you'd hate Nixon, of course. This is not hard to understand. But the idea of being blinded by hatred, never a good idea. Otherwise, you get so blinded by your hatred of Bush that you get Obama, or so blinded by your hatred of Obama that you get something even worse. Well, similarly back then, I think a lot of peace activists, anti-war activists, left liberals in general, were completely taken in by this Ellsberg thing. This was a part of an establishment policy. One of the things it also sought to do, of course, was to essentially scuttle the Vietnam War, that this had become counterproductive, the world was moving on, it was time to put an end to this. And given the typical problems of American democracy, it's very hard to do that. I mean, de Gaulle found in France how hard it is to end the Algerian War under those circumstances, and he was a very strong leader. Here in the U.S., you have this Wall Street faction, rogue network faction in the background that wanted to weaken the presidency and end the Vietnam War at the same time. So the vehicle that they chose was the Pentagon Papers. This time it's much worse. It's not ending a war. It's simply shifting from this emphasis on the Afghan theater into the emphasis on Iran and also on Pakistan. And I wouldn't rule out an attempt even to put the Pakistan government under pressure. You can play Pakistan against Iran. Why not? You try to line up Pakistan with Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and some others, and play that against Iran, and then those Pakistani nukes can be working for you. They can eventually go to their targets in Iran. And I think that's ultimately what's being done. So when Ellsberg comes out, he says, Assange is the new me. Assange is the mini-me. He's the new Pentagon Papers, and Assange glories. Assange says, "Yes, I'm the new mini Ellsberg. I'm the new Pentagon Papers." And they're both right, provided that you know that the Pentagon Papers were, in short, a CIA op, and that Assange and WikiLeaks are also a CIA op in this broad sense.
Now, I didn't realize that Iran figured so heavily in the WikiLeaks.
Oh, yes.
Well, now there's also some new documents that WikiLeaks have put up. These are government encrypted documents. What about that?
Look, I think more than the details of what they put up and the sort of ins and outs, we had, for example, for 2 weeks, the Pentagon said nothing, and now the Pentagon said, aha, you have 15,000 documents of ours, then we want them back, and you should give them back. We'll go through many iterations of this. It's all designed to keep the story in the public eye. It has not succeeded nearly as well as the Pentagon Papers. But let me just a couple of more things on the genesis of this. We have a figure called Cass Sunstein, and Cass Sunstein today, of course, is the intellectual regulation czar of the Obama White House. And I would regard this person as a totalitarian thinker. In other words, a liberal, a totalitarian liberal, perhaps in the tradition of Lord Keynes and some of these people in Britain. He's a great admirer of Jeremy Bentham, which I think is a very bad philosophical pedigree to have. The first time I ever read about WikiLeaks was an article by Cass Sunstein here in the Washington Post on February 24th, 2007. And this was an article that said, great news, there's a new organization that's going to attack China. It's a group of Chinese dissidents with Western backers outside of China, and they're going to get leaks that are really embarrassing to the Beijing government, and this is going to be a wonderful thing. It's called WikiLeaks. And indeed, that's where this seems to come from. If you look at the board of WikiLeaks, you will find a number of these very suspicious Chinese dissidents. We have Wang Dan, who works for the U.S. National Endowment for Democracy, according to reports published by Wayne Madsen on his Wayne Madsen Report. We have this guy, Xiao Cheng, of the University of California at Berkeley, who broadcasts on Radio Free Asia, which is reputedly linked to Soros and perhaps funded by Soros. We have to also remember that Xiao Cheng is part of the International Committee for Tibet. These groups were mobilized at the occasion of the Dalai Lama, the darling of feudalists, mystics, and Western elitists, when he came to the White House and met with Obama, albeit in unofficial form. We've also got a guy called Kam Sit Sang, who's also a big Tibetan activist. So you look at the WikiLeaks board, and you find a group of Western-backed, sort of U.S. intelligence community-linked Chinese activists. Another figure on the board, Ben Laurie, former security director of Google. Now, the genesis of Google, simply, there was a company called InQtel. InQtel was the CIA proprietary. The desire was to keep the U.S. intelligence community up to date in IT and infotech in general. Google has been the product of that. Now, there was even one of the U.S. Satellite mapping programs called Operation Keyhole. The U.S. NSA program for satellite mapping was transferred to Google. This was Operation Keyhole, and the money for that was provided, I believe, by InQtel. And lately this year, as Google got into a big fight with China, It essentially emerged that they were in a united front with the National Security Agency, that Google and the NSA were basically united in the struggle against China. So, and then again, the Soros overtones of many of these figures, I think this is also quite relevant. And perhaps we should say something about Julian Assange himself.
In that regard, Webster, you brought up Cass Sunstein. Now, Cass Sunstein, wasn't it part of his job with the Obama administration to cast aspersions on people who were investigating the events of September 11th? Now,
right.
hasn't Julian Assange made some comments himself about what he thinks about 9/11?
Assange has made the statement in the last 10 days where he says that 9/11 Truth and 9/11 Truth activists annoy him. 9/11 Truth annoys him. So this is basically an argument saying the only conspiracies that are allowed, that are admissible, are my conspiracies, which are these low-level things, if at all. But the big ones are not approved. You can also see that out of this 90,000 piece document dump, there are no scandals. There's nothing in there about Bush or Cheney or Rumsfeld. There's no basis of any Nuremberg prosecutions against Obama or against Gates or Hillary Clinton or any of these people, right? Any Leon Panetta. There are no high-level scandals. It's all essentially at this very low level. So I think what you're pointing to, and I'm glad you reminded me of it, Cass Sunstein had, in addition to heralding the coming of WikiLeaks when Sunstein was a professor at the University of Chicago, he's a friend of Obama from there, Sunstein then came out with this thing that you've got to disrupt the 9/11 Truth movement and anybody who advocates conspiracies. And what they mean by that generally is anybody who declines to accept official U.S. government or Wall Street media purveyed explanations of anything are ipso facto conspiracy theorists, paranoid, and they have to be disrupted. And the way you do that, he says, is essentially in disguise. In other words, you do it covertly by going onto the internet, creating sites that promote the cognitive disruption of those movements or those currents of opinion, and it looks to me like WikiLeaks is essentially that. In other words, it fills the bill exactly in terms of what Cass Sunstein was talking about before. But perhaps now about Assange. I find him a strange figure. I find him bloodless, emotionless. I find him extremely detached. Notice again, he doesn't like 9/11 Truth, and he does not advocate the ending of these wars. I mean, a simple demand of stop the wars, bring the troops home, is not shared by Assange. Assange has said in public that WikiLeaks has no opinion about whether there should be an Afghan war or other wars, but only that it should be done in the most humane possible way, which I find a very weak position, right? Basically impotent in the extreme. And he also says everything should be transparent. But of course, the transparency seems to regard certain groups and not others. We have, for example, Norm Coleman, a former senator from Minnesota who was targeted, and this is coming from Wayne Madsen, targeted by the Soros interests because Coleman was opposing the appointment of a certain Malik Brown from the UN to be the head of the World Bank. And Coleman said, no, it has to be an American citizen. And at that point, the German branch of WikiLeaks under a certain Daniel Schmidt, which is probably a pseudonym, Daniel Schmidt came up with a whole bunch of embarrassing credit card materials from the Coleman campaign that were leaked. And now, of course, we have Al Franken, who's got that Senate seat. So Coleman was successfully defeated in the process. The idea is, if you're going to do disinformation, you have got to establish your credibility and your bona fides by putting out real stuff, at least some real stuff, you know. But then you can mix in the disinformation and the special targeting once you've essentially duped a lot of people into thinking that you're the real thing. Now, with Assange, what could the background be? Well, we find that in his youth, and I'm citing now Wikipedia, just the Wikipedia entry for Assange's biography, he was on the run for much of his youth with his mother and half-brother. The mother, after giving birth to Assange, had gone on to a second husband, I guess. And this second husband, the father of Assange's half-brother, was a member of a cult in the area of Melbourne, Australia. And this is the Anne Hamilton Byrne cult, B-Y-R-N-E. And according to Wikipedia, this cult specialized in the administration of LSD and powerful psychopharmaca to very young children. And their method was to take a child of 5 to 10 years old, give them LSD, perhaps give them psychopharmaca at the same time, and then put them into a dark room and maybe go interview them later on. I don't know whether Assange himself has ever been through this. I think that's an interesting question. But the background in the Anne Hamilton Byrne cult, I think, is relevant. Otherwise, we find that Assange grew up as part of a touring theatrical company, and that during his youth he attended no fewer than 37 different schools. So 37 schools, I guess that's a lot. So the idea that he's picaresque, that he goes from place to place as a nomad and lives out of a backpack or a suitcase, I guess that's understandable. He then emerges as a computer hacker in the 1990s. I think we need to keep focused right now. The main thing that's going on in the world is that the U.S. and Israel and, I guess, others, right, NATO countries, hard to tell exactly who, they're gearing up to attack Iran. And this is not the same old, because there's a period of about 2 to 2.5 years when that was not the case. You'll recall, in 2007, there was the last attempt by the rogue network, the group behind Cheney. They attempted and they commandeered a B-52 with 6 nuclear cruise missiles, and they took that from North Dakota to Louisiana, and that was on the way to the Middle East at the same time that the Israelis were about to attack Syria on the 7th of September 2007. That was the rogue B-52. That attempt fell apart. That was a hijacking of a nuclear-armed strategic bomber by the Cheney group. And there has not even been a congressional investigation of what happened with that. It has been completely buried, because there was a case where you had a bunch of rogue network characters caught in the act. And they covered that up, and there was a special commission with James Rodney Schlesinger that purged a bunch of Air Force generals. There was a stand down of the U.S. Air Force for one day. They fired the head of the Air Force member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They fired the U.S. Secretary of the Air Force, the civilian commander, got rid of both of them. But there's never been a full airing of what happened there. Anyway, that was, I think, pretty much the last gasp on the attacks under Bush Cheney, because by then, in December of 2007, you had the National Intelligence Estimate coming out and saying, we state with high confidence that Iran has no, zero nuclear program, weapons program. There is no Iranian nuclear weapons program. And that was the authoritative opinion of the NIE in December 2007. And that essentially ruled out any attack. What's going on behind the scenes now is that there's going to be a new national intelligence estimate. And I think it's pretty clear that this one is going to say, we were misled, we were lied to, we were wrong. There is an Iranian nuclear weapons program. And in the essay that I wrote, I advanced the hypothesis that one of the ways they might very well try to motivate the change is to say, we were relying on this guy Amiri, this Iranian nuclear scientist who, you'll recall, put a video on YouTube saying, help, I'm being held in Tucson, Arizona, and I've been kidnapped, and I want to get out of here. And then he eventually did go back to Iran. What the U.S. will do with this case is he was obviously somebody who had been brought here and paid a lot of money to say there is an Iranian nuclear program. But that is not what they're going to announce. They're going to announce that Amiri had been working for them in 2006 and 2007, and that he was a double agent, and he lied to the U.S., and he said, guys, there is no Iranian nuclear program, and they believed him. But now that they see he's a double agent, they're revisiting the question, and now they find that there is an Iranian nuclear program. So that was my prediction. And then, interestingly enough, in the Wall Street Journal, a few days later, we find the following article. This is 9 days after my article. Here we are in the Wall Street Journal on Friday, July 30th. How the CIA Got It Wrong on Iran's Nukes by Edward J. Epstein. Now, you may remember Edward J. Epstein. He is one of the main defenders of the Warren Commission report on the Kennedy assassination, one of the main attackers of Jim Garrison, the New Orleans district attorney, and his investigation into the Kennedy assassination. And what he goes through here is, again, that Amiri was a double agent, and he lied to the U.S., and now that we know that he was a double agent, we've got to go back and change the NIE. And there's a whole cottage industry of neocons now who are eager to make a comeback, who are pressing for various ways to get this new NIE. And one such proposal is to have an alternative body come up with an NIE. In other words, the CIA NIE is not going to be good enough. What you've got to do is to get outside experts. And, of course, that's Team B. That's what Bush did in 1976 when he was head of the CIA. He brought in a bunch of people, Richard Perle, Richard Pipes, neocons, in effect. Maybe not called neocons then, but neocons, who came in and gave the direst warnings about what the Soviets were up to, that there was a window of vulnerability and all the rest of it. So now the neocons are pressing to have a new Team B. And indeed, as the war buildup goes on, we see Team B, we see every old, discredited neocon parlor trick, every cheap parlor trick of the neocons is now being dragged out. We have the cover story in the Weekly Standard, written by 2 weeks ago by Royal Mark Gerecht, CIA veteran, saying Iran will be a cakewalk. Same story that we heard. And
another cakewalk.
Another cakewalk. And, of course, the whole story with Amiri is that he's essentially a new source curveball, or at least he would have been a source curveball if he hadn't gone back to Iran. But they were paying him to be curveball, and then he turned into something else. But one way or the other, they were going to get out of him that there was an Iranian nuclear weapons program. Now, just on that, one of the more reputable sort of mainstream centrist Iran experts here in Washington is a guy called Flint Leverett, and together with his wife Judy Mann Leverett, they run the Race for Iran website, which you can look at. They say there is no Iranian nuclear weapons program as far as they know. And there is no proof. This is just like Saddam Hussein and the weapons of mass destruction. And it's the classical case, as the Downing Street memo said, right? This was the head of MI6 reporting back to London saying the facts and the intelligence are being fixed around the policy. So you're going to know that war is close, or at least one of the scenarios to get to war is that there'll be a new NIE, and it will say, we were wrong. We must now view with alarm that Iran is so close to getting a nuclear weapon that that they may indeed have it before we know it, and they'll have a test detonation before anybody knows it. And when you start to hear that, that's a warning that that the attack is close.
Well, can anybody start writing NIEs? I mean, this is supposed to be an official document, isn't it?
It is, but it's now being, of course, it's always politically cooked. It was politically cooked then, although in those days, I think that corresponded to the truth of the matter. That NIE of December 2007 was another way of saying the Bush-Cheney neocon faction is defeated. And we had Robert Gates, a Brzezinski man, as head of the Pentagon, and we're gonna deprive the neocons and the Israelis, for that matter, of the ability to attack Iran during the last year of Bush-Cheney. But now, the whole Obama experiment, right, the whole trilateral Obama-Brzezinski policy is not getting the results that they wanted. Again, the Iranian color revolution is a complete failure. And now there are other things going on, right? There's also then the fact that you've got Turkey escaping from U.S. control. The Turkish and Brazilian attempt to mediate the entire Iranian nuclear question has profoundly shocked the State Department as well as the British, right? The idea that, that regional powers like Turkey would begin to have something to say about peace in the world in general, or that Brazil would have something to say about Iran, I think for them is a very unwelcome novelty. I think it would be good. It would get us towards a more polycentric world, less dominated by these five permanent members of the UN Security Council.